Welcome, I'm Owen Woods, reporter for Alamosa Citizen, and this is a special episode of The Valley Pod. Joining us in our studio on the south side of Alamosa is Vivian Smotherman, the Democratic candidate for the Colorado State Senate District 6 race. Her opponent is Republican incumbent State Senator Cleve Simpson. Welcome to The Valley Pod, Vivian. We appreciate you having you on today.
Absolutely. Thanks for inviting me. Glad to be here in Alamosa. We've spent a lot of time in the last six, 8 weeks here. Nice. And just getting to love it.
I heard you were at Beat the Heat this weekend.
We were. We were out serving beers for Spare Keg Brewery.
Nice. You pour a lot of beers that night?
I poured a lot of beers that night. Had a blast.
Get to have any barbecues or Bloody Marys while you were there?
I did get to sample the winner of the Bloody Mary contest, which happened to be the owner of the Spare Keg Brewery that I was working for that night. And I got some of that Gozer sausage, which is, as someone that used to make their own sausage, absolutely loved it.
That's what we'll get into that. We'll kind of get into your history of farming there for a minute. But yeah, those Gozer sausages are pretty good. Can't beat them. All right. So we'll start this conversation with some questions affecting Coloradans, specifically constituents in Senate District 6 and our main focus, which is the residents of San Luis Valley. But first, we'll take a minute or two and we'll just have you introduce yourself, kind of tell us who you are, where you are, and most importantly, why you're running for this position.
That is the most popular question. Why are you running? Why are you doing this? All right. So my name is Vivian Smotherman. I'm running for the Senate District 6 seat. I will tell you a little bit about my history. I am a Navy veteran. I just did my regular enlistment and then I got out. And then I joined, I spent 10 years working in wireless communications because I was a radioman in the Navy and it seemed like a natural fit. Mm-hmm. And eventually, in my heart, I'm a sailor. And I had to get back to the sea. So I went to the oil and gas industry, and I worked for over 20 years offshore.
Do you get back out on the water anymore these days, now that you're landlocked here in Colorado?
No. The only thing I love more than water is mountains. So
it's hard to beat.
Absolutely.
So we want to kind of get a good sense to kind of get where you're at. What do you see as some of the main issues in Senate District 6 that you would like to address at the state level?
Well, as I traveled around, Senate District 6 is 14 counties. And as you travel around, you talk to everybody, you get their input, and you find out what these issues are. The main ones everywhere I go are housing. Nobody can afford a house. Their kids can't afford to live where they live. So that is heavy on people's minds, that and the cost of living. Secondly is rural health care. We do not have access to the same services our friends on the Front Range do. And that is something people want to correct. And where we do have services, they tend to cost more, and we have more trouble with insurance companies because we don't have as many providers out here.
Right.
So these are issues that are affecting people, and they're costing people more money. And then finally, obviously, our education system in Colorado is underfunded, and that is hurting us as a state as a whole, in particular rural counties and rural areas that we have down here in SD6. Mm-hmm.
So one of your main platforms is fighting for women's rights. So we're kind of in a state where that's a large talking point. It's a big issue. What legislation would you want to introduce in the area of women's health and women's reproductive rights that Colorado currently doesn't offer?
Right now, we have Initiative 89 is on the ballot this year. So I think we're all very hopeful, and I think we're all very confident that is going to put enshrine abortion access and women's health care into the Colorado Constitution and make sure it's not something that can be taken away or at least easily taken away. Mm-hmm. So that is the number one goal with that. If that doesn't succeed, then we have to look at other options. But I'm very optimistic that bill's going to pass with flying colors.
I agree. As a senator, would you continue to support Colorado's place in the country as a sanctuary state for those seeking abortions?
Oh, absolutely, 100%.
Why is, in your opinion, why is it important to maintain that position in this country?
Because the states where they've made it illegal, I mean, they are treating women as second-class citizens. Mm-hmm. That's reprehensible. Okay, women are not second-class citizens. Men do not get to make choices for women. That's just inappropriate. My mother didn't raise me that way. My father didn't raise me that way. So I'm here to make sure that women don't get put in that position here in this state and that the women that are in this position in other states have a place to go where they can feel safe and get the care they need without risking their lives.
As you campaign across SD6, what's kind of the feel for women's reproductive rights, particularly abortion. What kind of things are you hearing? How is that popping up in conversation?
There's a lot of optimism about Initiative 89. SD6 was, I believe, the first Senate district to collect the required amount of signatures for the Initiative 89 to get on the ballot, and I believe we collected more signatures than most other districts. So it's definitely on women's minds. Mm-hmm. It's definitely on people's minds, and people are definitely supporting this issue and supporting protecting women.
Kind of in the realm of health. In the most recent Mental Health America survey that just came out this week, Colorado is ranked 46th in the nation, particularly for access to mental health care services and the general condition of our youth and adults. 46th is not good for a state that kind of boasts a healthy environment, clean, easy access to outdoors. How are we falling so far behind, and do you have any plans as your position in senator, if you're elected, to kind of expand that access to rural medical, mental?
Absolutely. Let's start by understanding that the 46 is horrendous. Again, we are the fittest state, mm-hmm, in the nation. So we're at least top one or two, because everybody here bikes, everybody walks, everybody's outside doing outdoor activities.
High elevation.
Absolutely. Yep. So health-wise, physically, we're a very healthy state. So it doesn't then really make sense that we are so far down on mental health until you take a look at the geography of Colorado and realize how much of this state is rural, mm-hmm, and how much that isolates people and how much that causes more problems. I think there was a Sun article a couple months ago talking about the rise in suicides and the rise in mental health problems in our farmers and ranchers. And that's a major concern, because that is an industry that when we rely on as a state, and we want it to be as profitable and productive as we can, and having farmers that are not mentally in a good place because they're depressed or sad or worried about the future is not good for our economy, and it's not good for them. I think when I think about why we're in such a bad state. Again, the geography, we're rural. It's mm-hmm. hard to get services. It's hard to attract good service providers into these smaller towns where these farmers live, the ranchers live. Mm-hmm. We need more providers there, mm-hmm, and we don't have that. So we need either telemed or we need some way to incentivize good providers to come into these communities and stay.
Would you try to, I guess, in your position as a senator, would you continue to really kind of hone in on that rural mental health care access? Because I feel like that's one of the things I constantly hear is there's nowhere to go, there's nothing to do. Do you see a lot of room in the state senate that can be improved?
Oh, absolutely. And again, it comes down to really addressing all three of those problems that we talked about a few minutes ago. Realizing that they all affect one another. Okay, they're all interrelated. They're all intersectional. So if we can improve housing, access to housing, affordability of housing throughout this district, okay, that makes it easier to incentivize healthcare providers, mental health care providers, psychologists, psychiatrists, therapists, to move into an area mm-hmm. where they can support themselves and make a living. So addressing housing mm-hmm. gives us an opportunity to also address mental health care.
You're raising an interesting point, one that I haven't heard too much on the in many campaign trails, on national and local level, is that housing, as research shows, is directly tied to mental health. And if you have a place to sleep and eat and reside in, your mental health can be at a place. So it's interesting that you're bringing this up. When did you start to kind of speak on the two issues and how they affect each other, how they go hand in hand?
Well, I think from the beginning I've looked at it, as I do all problems, mm-hmm. is don't try to isolate a problem and just solve that one. You have to look at how that's going to affect other things, positively and negatively. Mm-hmm. And housing is definitely one that if you improve it in a community, that is going to improve the community in a number of ways, a number of facets. Again, incentivizing, bringing people into the community that will stay and then provide skills and services that the community needs to survive and support itself.
And so let's actually move on to housing. I have a couple specific initiative questions, but I want to ask you, you are campaigning on affordable housing. This is a two-part question. Why is affordable housing, and you partly answered that with mental health, but why is affordable housing important? And in its current state, do you see that Colorado is in what you might call a crisis of affordable housing right now?
Oh, we're definitely in a crisis of affordable housing. I think the numbers for just Denver County alone, were that they were short over 70,000 units at this point. And that's in Denver. Mm-hmm. So out here in rural Colorado, it is even worse. Durango, where I'm living right now, where I have my house, we got really lucky to find a place when we came back to Colorado, and we found a place we could afford. But I'd been working in the oil industry for 20 years, so I had a little bit more resources to buy a house with when we sold our other place. We could afford a house in Durango. My children do not have that option. There's no job in Durango. There's no job in Southwest Colorado that would support the kind of income you need to live in one of these communities. And that's what the real tragedy, mm-hmm. is that my kids can't live here, my grandkids can't come live here without a lot of help from me. Mm-hmm. So I definitely think housing is a huge issue throughout this district.
It's kind of a separate issue, perhaps. Are short-term rentals part of that problem? How do you view short-term rentals?
Short-term rentals can be part of that problem. It depends on how each community is dealing with them. Durango has a very tight control over short-term rentals within the city itself, meaning they've put a cap on it. I think it's like 7 to 10%, somewhere in there. So it's very small, but it allows that these units are not sitting empty 8 months out of the year just to be used once in a while, where we have workers that literally have to move down to New Mexico and drive up every day just to maintain work because there's no places in Durango.
Absolutely. So if you're elected and you want to address affordable housing, do you have laws, policies that you're kind of already running around in your head that you'd like to introduce?
I'm not going to introduce anything special. What I'm going to say is that as I've traveled around this district, the wealth of information and creativity that I'm finding in our county commissioners is unbelievable. We have county commissioners that are doing some incredibly aggressive and creative programs to address the housing in their counties. Mm-hmm. And by traveling around and talking to these people, seeing the programs, seeing the houses, seeing the results that they get, those are inspiring. And that tells me that when I get to Denver, those are the people I need to be in touch with, those are the people I need to be talking to, and those are the people I need to make sure we are funding, make sure that they are getting the money they need to continue those programs, because they're the ones that are on the ground with their boots on the ground that are fixing and addressing this problem. As a senator, my job is to make sure that they have the funding to continue that.
Initiative 50 and Initiative 180 are kind of high on...
108?
Or 108. Yeah, 108, excuse me. I wrote it down wrong. Their property tax valuation is high on people's radar right now. I mean, people don't want their property taxes raised, but there's a wealth of reasons. We just want to get your kind of feel on these two initiatives and how you see them in the grand scheme of things here.
Honestly, I hope everybody votes no on both initiatives. They're not good for Colorado. They're not good for communities. They're not good for the state as a whole. So we have to understand that they are not where we want to be going right now. These are other solutions. And I read, but yesterday it came out, I think the governor's thinking of calling another special session, right. Mm-hmm. Because they may have a way to take 50 and 108 off the ballot if they can make an agreement with the person that was pushing those through. So that was the last I heard, is that if they can come to an agreement, we can get those pulled off and we can have more time to fix this solution in the years to come.
How do you see this potential second attempt to address this at the state level? What does that say to you as somebody who's running for this position as a legislator?
I think we have a governor that really cares, and he's trying to do the best for the state. Everybody in the legislature, all the representatives and senators that I've talked to and that I do talk to regularly, and even the county commissioners again, they all realize that these are bad bills. These are bad ballot measures, and we don't want them because they will take money away from communities, they will take money away from schools, they will take money away from all of the things that we need to survive, infrastructure, etc. So we cannot have these bills. We need to make sure we maintain control over our budget that much, mm-hmm. and find solutions that will work now so that gives us time to find solutions that will work better later.
Do you have any proposals that you would want to advance in this area? Anything about capping fees or looking at different avenues?
Well, again, I think Colorado suffers from Tabor. We've suffered from Tabor for 30 years. And while a lot of people or some people think it's good that they get that $700, $800 check, the more I look into it, the more I see that that has raised other fees that we pay to an astronomical level that nobody else in the country pays. So getting that $700, $800 check in October, is it worth then paying $800, $900, $1,000 for your car registration every year where they're trying to make these make up the money that they're losing otherwise. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of been talk about Tabor over the last 30 years and what to do about it. And I think always this conversation about funding Colorado properly has to start with a review and an adjustment of Tabor somehow. If we get rid of it, that would be ideal. Mm-hmm. That'll be a long ballot fight, but I'm prepared for that fight if we can do it.
Excellent. A couple other, a big ballot measure I just want to kind of get a read on you from. The state legislature, referred a ballot measure that would collect 11% retail sales on firearm sales, or sales tax on firearm deals. How do you see that? How does that rank in your position?
I'll tell you, I understand why they're doing that, I think. And I'm big for addressing our problem with firearms and violence without taking people's firearms away. I don't think just raising taxes on those particular people is the correct approach. I think, again, it starts with education. It starts with making our education system better. And it's an understanding that guns have their place and we need to be responsible gun owners.
I want to get back to affordable housing. It's a big deal. There's a lot going on. If you're elected in this position, where in your first days of legislating, where does affordable housing fit? Where do you start to really hammer that home?
I think that's really at the top of the list. Mm-hmm. As I said, I think the Tabor is going to be a long haul fight.
Right.
Okay. I'm in for it. I'm ready for it. I'm anxious to get on that. But housing, I think, is a much quicker or direct route to finding solutions, or at least finding ways to help the people out there that have solutions. Mm-hmm. So housing is very much at the top of that list. Getting the money that's necessary to the people that have the solutions is where I'm going to start.
And also I want to get to public education. Where do you, I guess, what would be a good funding formula that you would support or recommend when it comes to the funding of K-12 education? Where do you approach that from?
let's get them as much money as we can. Let's start with that. Here's the way it's been put to me over and over again. Again, Colorado, by the numbers, is one of the most educated states. I think we're number 3 or 4 in the country as far as educated population. We have degrees. We're smart people. However, our education system is, again, 45, 46th in the nation. And if you look at our teacher salaries adjusted for inflation, they're the lowest in the nation. Mm-hmm. Okay, that means that our educating our children is not putting out the children that are ranking us so high in the state's education. That's other people moving into the state that have educations, okay, which means that they're coming in and taking jobs away from our children because our children are not educated to that same level. So we need to acknowledge that if we don't spend more money on education, if we don't improve our system, we're going to keep losing jobs and our kids are going to continue to not be able to afford the life that we've lived.
So kind of saying that the line item for education needs to be increased year over year. This is kind of would be a good approach, or perhaps perhaps something that needs to be done that should have been done a while ago, perhaps.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
What about the push for universal pre-K? How do you feel about that?
Oh, I love it.
Yeah,
I love it. I mean, again, childcare is another major issue mm-hmm. that goes along with the other ones, and it's part of education. I think La Plata County has capacity for less than 50% of the child care that it needs as a county.
Wow.
Okay. Archuleta County is about the same place. Cortez and Montezuma County are also in that same place. There's more children than we have child care available, which drives up the price, and there's a waiting list that is very hard for parents to adapt to.
Absolutely.
Because you are stuck at home. If you're a parent, you cannot go out and get your job and make your money if you have to raise your kids and pay for them. So, if you can't afford child care for that. So I think having mandate or paying for pre-K is a no-brainer.
Kind of shift into our final segments here. We want to kind of tap into water, natural resources, and environment. But first, I think how I want to start this out is kind of understanding your background more in oil and gas, just kind of mainly learning or understanding how you got into that business and what you did throughout your career there.
I started in oil and gas, again, over 20 years ago. I did laid pipe in the Gulf of Mexico. So we started out pipe laying. From there, I went to ROVs and trenching, where I buried the pipe with remote operated vehicles. I was a superintendent on those vessels. And finally, I spent the last 3 years of my career doing well intervention. Well intervention in the oil industry offshore is where you come into these wells that are no longer in service. Okay, usually that means that their productivity has fallen to the point where it's no longer profitable for the oil company to run that well. Now, rather than just turning off the valve and walking away, which what the oil industry has been doing for the past 20, 30, 40 years, now as a society, as a globe, we've come together and said, no, that's no longer good enough because these wells, they rust, they fall apart, they deteriorate, and then those pollutants, those open wells expose and roll into our atmosphere, our oceans. So well intervention, we would go in, we would remove all the debris around the well, and then we would properly seal it up. You go down in it, you fill it with cement, you cap it, and then they're safe. And that's what is supposed to happen in Colorado, and it's not happening. So we have thousands of wells in Colorado, with my understanding, that are, again, the valve was turned off, but nobody has properly shut down that well, which creates an environmental hazard.
So I guess that kind of leads into how you view the expansion of oil and gas in Colorado. What's your position on that? And then in turn, where does this problem get addressed for these caps? How do we go back and fix this retroactive problem?
Well, we're going to have to hold these companies accountable that caused the problem. Okay, they've had their profit, they've taken their profit out of it, and now the big oil companies consistently try to shift that responsibility for closing down the well by selling the well to a smaller company that cannot afford it. So we need to stop that loophole. One suggestion I've heard that I like, but need some more research, is making sure that they put a bond down when they get a well drilling permit. Put a bond down. $100,000, $200,000, whatever it costs to close down that well. Put that bond somewhere in the state's custody, and if they want to sell the well, they can sell the bond too. But that way the state always has the money to make sure that those wells can be closed down properly.
And so, many Coloradans see the expansion of oil and gas as this economic driver that could be good for us, but others, they see a detriment to the environment. They see a lot of pollutants. They see big oil coming into Colorado's pristine places, fracking. Where do you see the expansion of oil and gas? Where does that fit, especially considering your background?
It always has to be a balance. Mm-hmm. I would love to see a shift to 100% in renewables, but I think the most realistic expectation is that's not going to happen overnight. Okay, we have to progress slowly to that point. While still engaging with the oil and gas industry, but doing it responsibly.
Right.
Okay. Holding them accountable, making sure that they're doing things well, because my 20 years experience in oil tells me they have the technology to do it well. They don't always have the discipline to do it well. If they can shave a few dollars off, they will. So again, holding them responsible, paying attention to what they're doing, have good oversight, and make sure that there's a plan in place to shut down wells responsibly, and even monitor the permits we're giving to make sure that they're not going into some place that is too fragile of an environment for them to be working and destroy it.
You think there's room for legislation to, restrict those kinds of things, or to make sure that these companies are held accountable by law?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely, I think we can. We're giving them permits to drill. That has to come with not just, hey, go ahead and do it. It comes with requirements. You can do it under these circumstances. And as long as you agree to that, then we're going to support you.
For people who maybe be against the expansion of oil and gas, considering your background, do you see that constituents might have a worry that you could be lobbied by big oil to prevent those kinds of things? I mean, this is, just a concern on people's minds.
Yeah, and that's where it comes down to trust. Mm-hmm. I do know how to deal with the oil companies. I have that experience. So you have to look at my entire resume and say, is this a person I can trust to attack the oil companies and defend my environment, my state, or is this someone that's going to sell out? Mm-hmm. So hopefully you get to know me and you realize I'm not someone that's going to sell out,
right,
that I'm much more likely and driven to support the community than to turn on it.
Mm-hmm. So with the recent SCOTUS overturning of the Chevron deference, what do you think can be done at a state level to make sure that regulation can continue?
I think what I've seen so far from the state has been outstanding. These communities are coming together, and the state is coming together and trying to protect their wetlands, as one example. And we have the tools, we have the resources, and we have the responsibility. They're the responsible people that know what to do. We just have to listen to them and make sure we're protected that way.
Excellent. So after your career in oil, you moved to Texas and started a farm.
They were simultaneous.
Simultaneous, excuse me. But you transitioned from oil and farming, or oil to farming, where you started a pretty cool program. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah. Let me real quick clarify. When you work in the offshore oil and gas industry, you typically work about 6 months a year. Okay. Mm-hmm. So with the other 6 months, we ended up, we bought a property just outside of Austin, Texas, and we lived there for over 15 years. And when you buy property, and the farmers and ranchers here in the valley will understand this, when you have land, suddenly you look at it and you say, there's potential. I want to do something with it. Mm-hmm. So that started us on the road. We started with 4-H and had our daughter raise pigs, had a wonderful experience with that, and then thought, well, let's raise more pigs. And one thing leads to another, and suddenly you're a pig farm before you knew it. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened to us. We were a heritage hog farm in Central Texas, trying to do GMO-free and organic as best we could. Mm-hmm. You cannot technically do organic in Texas because there wasn't an organic slaughterhouse available to us. And the rules are such that we couldn't market our stuff as organic that way. But during that time, and this is what you were getting to, we started a nonprofit to help farms. Mm-hmm. Particularly, it started with Hurricane Harvey that rolled into Texas, and it wiped out not only our farm and fences, but a lot of our friends' farms and fences. And it took a lot of work and a lot of manpower to clean up the debris, put the fences back up, and get the animals back in their pen. So having been there and having the personality that I do, it was easy for me to make the phone calls, to organize the people, to get everything in motion to provide people and equipment to go out to these farmers that were around our area that had gotten devastated, to take trucks and trailers out there to load up the debris, the dead wood, the trees, all the trash that had flown in, or blown in, and then also rebuild their fences and help them in whatever way we could. So by doing that program, which we did starting with Hurricane Harvey, it led to what else can we do to help these farmers? One of the big concerns we had, what we noticed when we first moved there, and we made all these mistakes from day one. We bought the land. We had just a small place, 10 acres. And then we spent $25,000 to hire someone to come in and clear this 25 acres, or this, I'm sorry, this 10 acres, which was an enormous amount of money that, in retrospect, we didn't have to spend because I, as someone without any real farming experience, was not going to be able to keep that 10 acres cleared before it would overgrow again. That was a lesson learned and something that we took then with the nonprofit and brought that to other farmers. When they would come out to the country, we would try to catch them before they made these mistakes that we made. And we would say, slow down. We're going to help you become successful. We're going to help you become sustainable, hopefully without you sinking yourself into $100,000 worth of debt. Mm-hmm. So don't clear all of your property, whether it's 10 acres, 20 acres, or 50 acres. Clear 1 acre. Plant 1 acre. Harvest 1 acre. Learn those lessons. And when you're ready, go to 2 acres or 5 acres. Mm-hmm. But do it in a step process. Don't try to do it all at once. Additionally, don't go out and spend $50,000 or $100,000 on a tractor.
Right.
Your neighbor has a tractor. He's a nice guy. Take him a gift and say, hey, can I borrow your tractor for an afternoon? Mm-hmm. Amazing how many farmers are willing to do that.
Well, there's a camaraderie that I think is easily tapped into, but it's also it's so neighborly. Even though your neighbors might be a couple miles apart, it's so neighborly. But I'm curious to see or to hear how your lessons farming and particularly in Texas, how that's shaping your conversations with constituents in this very rural agricultural place.
Oh, you're absolutely right. This is an incredibly agriculturally heavy district. Mm-hmm. It allows me to talk to them because I know their experiences, I know their hardships, and I know ways to find solutions for them. I know where their concerns lie, and I can, again, sympathize with them and help find solutions to them. Mm-hmm. So it's been really good to have that experience as I've traveled around, and I can talk to farmers on their level, talk to ranchers on their level. and understand their problems. Mm-hmm. So that makes a difference. Just having someone that they can talk to that understands them makes a huge difference for them.
Absolutely. What do you have to say to Colorado voters who don't believe you represent them since you're not from here, that you're from Texas or lived in Texas? What do you say to those people? Because that is a large point of contention.
I hear that a lot. Two things. I grew up in Colorado.
Right.
Okay. So loved it. I moved away when I joined the military, and then it literally took me 20, 30 years to come back here. Mm-hmm. I did own a farm in Texas, and I was working on it because that's where the oil and gas industry is. But literally, I've spent the last 20 years working all over the world and only spending that off time back in Texas. So while I was living there, I've always been a Coloradan at heart, and it's taken me this long to get back here. Mm-hmm. And now that I'm back here, I'm at a point in my life where it was a wonderful opportunity to say, how can I give back to this community that has given me so much? Mm-hmm. Because I am the person I am today because of growing up in Colorado and the things and the lessons and the life that allowed me to really explore and live.
Absolutely. I think once you're from here, you're from here.
Yeah. You know?
So want to get another gauge on that. Mm-hmm. With agriculture in this rural area, Colorado River, Rio Grande River, where would you say your comfort level is in the area of water issues, particularly in the upper Rio Grande Basin?
My confidence in my understanding of the issues and right. the problems, it grows every day. Mm-hmm. I've made a lot of, when I entered this race day one, I was told, you have to know water in this district. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I went out and I've learned water. Okay. I've gone to the conferences, I've gone to the meetings, and I pay attention. I read all the articles. I'm not the best expert in the world on it, but I'm aware enough that I understand how these systems work, who's controlling them, what the status is now, and what we're looking for in the future. Obviously, next year we're renegotiating or talking about the Colorado River Compact, mm-hmm. Which is going to be a huge mess.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
My understanding, again, went to a water conference a few months back up at the Southern Ute Tribe, right. which is a great event they put on. And they talked about how it's supposed to be an even split between the upper basin and the lower basin for the Colorado, but historically the lower basin is taking a third or more of our water from the upper mm-hmm. basin just because we haven't been using it. Mm-hmm. They say, oh, well, it's left over, you didn't use it, so we get to use it in downstream. That's hurting our farmers because our farmers are really struggling to get enough water to raise their crops. We have farmers that are transitioning away from water-heavy crops to water-light crops just because they don't have enough water. Mm-hmm. But we're losing so much water down to the lower basin because we're not using it right away that needs to be addressed and fixed. The right. Rio Grande is pretty much in the same spot, is that we have a lot of good water, but we have a lot of people that want it too.
Right. So a lot of downstream obligations.
A lot of downstream yes. obligations. I was following the Supreme Court case for the Rio Grande Water Compact. I've forgotten. I'm not sure where. I haven't heard a result for that yet.
Yeah, right. The Supreme Court did not agree in the state's favor, which kind of opens a lot of doors that I don't think people wanted open. But where with kind of this world you're entering, where do you see water management heading? What does the future of water management look like from a legislative perspective?
Water management is going to be incredibly important, but it's not a single point system where one group of legislatures is going to solve it.
Right.
Especially when you're talking interstate compacts, most of this is controlled by the federal level. The state has a lot of influence on it and mm-hmm. definitely has a lot of influence on supporting programs that conserve water, supporting farmers in those same senses. And CSU is doing an amazing job of right. that. So as a legislator in Colorado, it's paying attention to what's going on at the federal level, putting as much pressure on them as you can to protect your water resources and protect the people in your district from losing any water, and making sure that the state and the people are getting compensated for all the water that's going downstream that we no longer have access to.
Right. And I guess perhaps how do you feel, or what do you think the path or the solution, or I guess better yet, do you think that the federal government should get involved when three states are agreeing with each other? Do you think that the federal government needs to get involved at that point when three state governments say, yes, we've come to a solution?
The issue there, especially with the Rio Grande Compact, is it's not just three states. Right. We also have to acknowledge that Mexico is involved in this agreement. So at that point, you have to have the federal government involved because we are dealing with another country entirely. Mm-hmm. If it was just Colorado, New Mexico, and Texas that were having this dispute, that would be one thing. But the fact that we have to acknowledge that Mexico is there, we have to acknowledge that we are supplying them as well, means that we have to keep them involved. So hope that answers the question.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We want to address something a little more sensitive of your campaign. We just want you to kind of discuss it further. After the Democratic Legislative Campaign Committee announced that your campaign was one to watch, in your announcement, you said you were fighting the millionaire incumbent Cleve mm-hmm. Simpson. Campaign finance reports show that roughly $3 million is in debt on ranches in Colorado. And it's not incumbent, especially San Luis Valley mm-hmm. ranches, where people may be rich in assets, but with major debt. What are you implying in that attack ad, and do you take debt into account?
Oh, I hope it wasn't taken as an attack ad. It's just a difference between me as a working class candidate mm-hmm. that if I liquidated everything today, I would not have $1 million in my pocket. Literally, I've been unemployed for 3 years while I've gone back to school and finished some degrees. I'm self-funding this campaign to a small extent, and we're raising money elsewhere. That's a working class candidate to me. Whereas my opponent is a wonderful man. Everybody likes him. I like him. However, like you said, he's got $2.4 million worth of agricultural debt. He's got 800 acres of alfalfa and I think 400-cow to calf operation. Okay. Those are not small operations. If he liquidated everything, he would be well above $1 million. If you have 800 acres in the San Luis Valley, is going to be a lot of money.
Absolutely.
So it wasn't meant as an attack in that way. Mm-hmm. It was just pointing out that his assets exceed mine significantly. And if he didn't want to work the rest of his life, he could make that happen.
Fair enough. And finally, before we let you go, again, thank you for taking the time. It's been a great conversation, and we've enjoyed learning about you. And I think the people of the San Luis Valley have appreciated your time here, especially since this is a new Senate district. This is kind of a learning curve for a lot of us. But we want to know, are there areas or state legislative committees that you feel your background is most important for, ones that you would try to be appointed to or try to get on?
I would definitely look at getting on the Agriculture Committee because I care about our farmers and ranchers. I know how much they suffer. I know how much stress they're under, mm-hmm. and I would like to do everything I can to alleviate that. I've been trying to do that for the last 15 years. I would also think I would fit well on the Energy Committee because of, again, that oil and gas background. I know how those companies work. I know how to talk to them. I know how to get things accomplished to overcome. By knowing what their motivation is, it's easier to overcome that. So that experience would work well in that. If there's other committees in there, I would look at education. I would love to be on education because outside of financing, I have another goal for education, and that is to see it switch away from this extreme focus on STEM careers that we seem to have shifted over the last 20 years mm-hmm. and get it back to a more balanced approach. Humanities are important.
Absolutely.
Civics are important. History is important. These are lessons that seem to have gotten lost in the shuffle because we've shifted away from just educating kids to forcing them into this thought pattern that says everything you do is so you can get a job. I don't think anyone's childhood should be spoiled by saying the only reason you're here every day is so you can learn how to get a job. Mm-hmm. Okay, learn, read, experience the life out there because it's amazing. There's so much information and so many things and so many career paths. Don't limit our children by forcing them down one path. Open it up, get our school system back to a balanced point mm-hmm. where we're producing educated citizens instead of just workers.
Absolutely. And my final question, how do you see yourself making a difference? What does that vision look like for you?
Wherever I end up, I'm going to make a difference. Mm-hmm. I always have. I think my ability to get people on board, my ability to bring people together and have them move in a productive direction is going to make a difference. I'm a problem solver that starts with the problem, finds the most direct solution, and then finds a way to get there. Okay? I throw out the other garbage, the emotion, the hate, or the love, or the enthusiasm. That all gets pushed aside because here's a problem. Let's find a solution. Mm-hmm. Okay? Do it in a straightforward manner, and it can make it work.
Excellent. thanks again, Vivian. It's been great talking with you again and learning about you. We wish you well and safe travels on your campaign trail. You've got just a few more months until election, so we wish you the wish you the best. Hope you find some time to kind of relax and recuperate. But yeah, thank you very much.
Absolutely. It's been a pleasure being here and sitting down.
Thanks for listening to the Valley Pod. Today's episode was produced by Javier Rodriguez. A full video of this interview will be posted on the Alamosa Citizen YouTube channel later this week. We'll see you around the Valley.
Join us every Wednesday at Mercadillo en el Río at the Rio Grande Farm Park. Únete a nosotros todos los miércoles, Mercadillo en el Río, locado en el Parque de la Granja del Río Grande. Grab dinner for the night and groceries for the week. Compra una cena y los comestibles de la semana. What started as a farm stand with a few farmers has grown into a thriving market with fresh, organic produce grown right on the property. Lo que comenzó como un puesto de granja con unos pocos agricultores se ha convertido en un próspero mercado con productos frescos y orgánicos cultivados en la propiedad. Our community farmers are joined by local artists, musicians, performers, and makers. A los agricultores de nuestra comunidad se unen artistas, músicos y criadores locales. We hope you'll join us this summer at Rio Grande Farm Park. Esperamos que te unas a nosotros este verano en Rio Grande Farm Park. Every Wednesday from 3 to 7 p.m. through October 2nd. Todos los miércoles de 3 a 7 p.m. hasta el 2 de octubre. Experience a farmer's market with a heartbeat. Disfruta de un mercado de agricultores con corazón.
Are you craving adventure? Step back in time with the entire family aboard the Cumbres and Toltec Scenic Railroad. Discover breathtaking mountain views and savor the historic charm on the longest and highest steam railroad in America. Feel the thrill of history come alive as you ride along the same tracks laid in 1880. All aboard for the 2024 season. Trains depart Tuesday through Sunday from Antonito, Colorado and Chama, New Mexico. Antonito train station is located just 30 miles south of Alamosa. Book today at CumbresToltec.com or call 888-286-2737.